This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. How many times have you waited in your doctor's office while your doc waved in some person carrying a heavy briefcase instead? Have you ever wondered where your doctor gets those free samples that you're glad to get because the pills would otherwise cost you $10 apiece? What you've been witnessing and wondering about is the complex and controversial relationship physicians have with the pharmaceutical industry, and you only saw part of it. A force of 90,000 drug reps routinely bring free samples and lunches to doctors' offices. It's not unusual for a drug company to bring in or pay thousands of dollars for lunch for the entire staff, dozens of people. Drug companies frequently pay physicians for speaking at lectures, and they foot much of the bill for continuing medical education in the U.S. They will pay travel expenses to fly people across country to listen to lectures about their products. And practicing physicians aren't alone. Their academic colleagues rely heavily on industry funding for clinical studies. In their defense, some doctors say interactions with drug companies encourage biomedical research and keep doctors up to date on new treatments. Others claim they aren't influenced by gifts or rewards, but some psychologists say that it's not the size of the gift, but the gifting itself that makes a doctor feel indebted to the drug industry. And when these practices came to light some years ago, some organizations began imposing monetary limits on gift-giving. The Pharmaceutical Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA, issued voluntary guidelines to drug companies and physicians. Many medical organizations, including the AMA, have similar recommendations. And in 2003, the federal government weighed in with guidelines on gift-giving and drug company-sponsored events. But are these guidelines enough? While expensive gifts are restricted, the drug industry still spends $13 billion a year on direct-to-physician promotion. This hour, we're going to take up the issue of conflicts of interest in medicine. Where does your doctor's loyalty lie? Are there conflicts of interest affecting your health? And what does the drug industry actually get for $13 billion a year when they talk to the doctors? Are they getting their money's worth? Maybe they're just paying too much and nothing's really happening. What do you think? Maybe you've got some issues and things that go on in your doctor's office you'd like to share with us. Questions? Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Ezekiel Emanuel, Dr. Emanuel, is a medical oncologist and bioethicist. He's the chair of the Department of Clinical Bioethics at NIH in Bethesda, and he speaks with us today not as a representative of NIH policy, but as a doctor and bioethicist. And Dr. Emanuel joins us today from Chicago. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Emanuel.
Thanks for having me again.
You're welcome. Dr. Sanford Friedman is a cardiologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York and an associate clinical professor in medicine and cardiology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He's here in our New York studios. Welcome to the program, Dr. Friedman.
Hi.
Jerome Kassirer is author of On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health, published in 2004 by Oxford University Press. He's a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, a distinguished professor at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston, and he joins us today from Kennebunkport, Maine. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kassirer.
Thank you.
Thomas Stossel. Dr. Stossel is the co-director of Hematology Division at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the American Cancer Society professor at Harvard Medical Cancer in Boston. He joins me today from Cape Cod. Welcome to the program, Dr. Stossel.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Kassirer, I went through some of the problems you see with potential conflicts of interest in the doctor's book at the beginning of the program. But in your book, even in the title of your book, On the Take, you outline many more. What do you think is of the worst sin of all of these?
Well, I think you did a terrific job outlining some of the gifts, especially the trivial gifts that drug companies provide for doctors. I think you also made an important point about gifting, and that is that there's a important feeling that when somebody gives you a gift, you ought to reciprocate in some fashion for it. The pens, pocket pens, and the coffee cups, and even the pizzas and lunches are really a small part of a bigger picture. The most important point that I want to make at the beginning is that in terms of the research that goes on between industry and physicians, I'm all for it. I'm in favor of that research. I think it's important. I think we need to continue the entrepreneurial spirit that has given us all these major advances in medicine that I've actually seen over the 40-some years of my own clinical experience. My concern is that the kind of spin-offs that drug companies provide for doctors, that is, consultations on marketing issues, the development of educational materials by doctors, the involvement of doctors, as you pointed out, as speakers for drug companies, the kinds of monies that are passed around between drug companies and physicians, I think, and I give many, many examples in the book, are things that tend to increase the chance of that there will be a bias in their recommendations, and that that bias can translate to risk to patients, to increased cost of medical care, and to a lot of hidden agendas that we really don't know about. The biggest problem is that we have all these conflicts of interest out there, and many, many examples of them. The problem is that we don't have a good fix on how widespread these conflicts are. We only have some information from medical meetings, such as the American Psychiatric Association meeting, where fully a third of the psychiatrists who were giving presentations to that meeting had important conflicts of interest, some of them as many as with 26 companies. So the problem is that a lot of this is hidden, and we just don't have the kind of transparency we need to understand how widespread the problem is.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedman, you're a practicing physician. Do you see these kinds of practices in your daily life?
Yeah, every day. But Dr. Kassira makes it sound like that there's a conspiracy, and it's true. There's always a chance of bias in just about everything you do in life. But in my practice, I must say I don't understand the bias. You see, these folks come by the office. They're often highly educated, attractive women, as it turns out, for some reason. And they're only allowed to say things which are approved by the FDA. They're not allowed to talk about off-labeled recommendations mm-hmm. for these drugs. It's actually quite boring. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't even know why they come by and say the same old thing over and over again. You know, but the other thing they do, which is in the public interest and their interest as well, is address, I think, the major scandal in this country, which is things like hypertension are underappreciated, undertreated. I think all the physicians here know it. Hyperlipidemia, the same. And so they bring attention to that fact in the hope that the spinoff will be not only better treatment of your patients, but eventually the use of their drugs. The drugs per se, most of us are in HMO practices, and the specific drugs that you use are limited by the deals that the patients make with the HMOs, so there isn't really a whole lot of latitude there.
And the lunches and the paid speeches, the $2,500 to go make a speech.
Well, I don't know.
That doesn't
bother
you? Those things you don't see as a conflict of interest.
Well, it's their money. I honestly don't know why they're spending it because, doctors aren't lemmings. There is no quid pro quo. I practice on Park Avenue. I don't practice on K Street. Mm-hmm. You know,
Wait a second. This is
okay. Emanuel. Fair enough.
Dr. Emanuel, go ahead.
I think we need to be a little more careful that it is very common for people who get money to say, you know, it doesn't influence my view. Right. You can hear that from politicians. You know, campaign contributions don't influence how I vote, and most of us as citizens are quite skeptical of that. And one would think that while the drug companies are not all knowing and always prudent, that they wouldn't be spending $13 billion on this if that didn't have some return. But on the other hand, I do think that it is important to try to emphasize that a lot of what happens is the drug companies trying to get you to prescribe medications for patients who should be on treatment, but you're not doing it. We do have a lot of data, and again, I agree with the comment that there are lots of conditions that are undertreated in this country. We've got a lot of data to that effect, and part of what they're trying to do is get you to treat people who ought to be treated, and that is a social good, even if they benefit at the same time. And the other part is, frequently what they're trying to get you to do is use their drug rather than their competitor's drug. You know, so a Pfizer person wants you to use Lipitor rather than you're prescribing Merck's Zocor for reduction of cholesterol. And, you know, there they do see an interest in market share in that particular niche, and the patient probably doesn't really care and probably doesn't hurt them really in those circumstances. But for the drug company, that switch could mean a lot of money. You know, and I know that many people inside the drug industry thinks this whole thing is futile because, you know, we have some people who are switching from Merck drugs to Pfizer drugs, and Merck is doing the same thing and switching some people from Pfizer drugs to Merck drugs, and that $13 billion is going out the door, but probably not as much switching is happening as it justifies that. But it's a game that everyone plays, so everyone's got to be in it too.
Mm-hmm. Is there a threshold, Dr. Emanuel, where you can take the pens and the coffee cups, but maybe you shouldn't make those do those $2,000 speeches?
Well, the rules certainly believe that, and most of the ethical analysis suggests that there is a sort of sliding scale, that low things are below what the lawyers and the ethicists call a de minimis, and that, you know, we shouldn't worry a lot about them. But it's the bigger ticket items that we should worry about. And I think to some degree that's probably true. But I think, you know, the flip side is, why do we make these pens? Why do they make the notepads with the company logo on if they had no particular effect?
Yeah, if they weren't, why spend $13 billion if they're not getting the results they obviously think they are? I have to take a break.
It's pretty cheap.
Dr. Emanuel, hang on, Dr. Emanuel, hang on, because we're fighting the clock and we'll never win that battle. So stay with us. We'll take a short break and come right back more talking about medicine in the doctor's office. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about bioethics in the doctor's office, ethicists, and with doctors and ethicists here on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. My guests are Dr. Zeke Emanuel, Dr. Sanford Friedman, Dr. Joan Kasserer, and someone who hasn't had a chance yet, Dr. Thomas Stossel. He is co-director of the Hematology Division at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the American Cancer Society professor at Harvard Medical Center in Boston. Dr. Stossel, let me address this to you. You've written that ethics activists have, quote, hijacked the dictionary definition of conflict of interest, and that finding doctors with ties to industry is like, quote, a witch hunt. That makes it sound like any relationship a doctor has with a drug company is a conflict of interest.
That's absolutely true, Ira. And I would say, given the, if you listen to the news, the problems in the world and the challenge in general and the challenges we have with medicine in particular, it's kind of sad that you're wasting an hour discussing conflict of interest. It's conflict of interest is a kind of mindset that has set in the last 15 or so years that emphasizes motives over facts. Now, Dr. Kassir mentioned how much medicine has improved in the last 40 years. That's about as long as I've been in it. When I was a resident, heart attack patients languished on my ward for a month. Imagine what that would cost at today's prices. We did nothing about their risk factors. We did nothing to improve their heart function for all intents and purposes. And it's while there's lots of room for improvement, medicine is far from perfect, it's nothing short of miraculous what's been accomplished. And it has not been accomplished because of the high professional standards of physicians or their aversion to commercialism. In fact, it is commercialism. It is only industry has delivered these products to the public. Now, a lot of that's at the research end, but getting doctors to appropriately use, understand these products, getting investors to understand, to unleash capital to get more of these products is all to the good.
Ira, it's Jerry Kassir again.
Yes,
I agree
fundamentally with everything that Tom said. I think the question of witch hunt I think anybody who's on the defensive often says there's a witch hunt going on. I think the question is whether patient care or research or the cost of care is influenced by the kind of thing that we're talking about. It's one thing to be opposed to regulation, opposed to top-down management and against journals, and in favor of private property and personal freedom and entrepreneurial risk-taking. And there's no doubt that universities and academic medical centers could never produce the kind of products, medical devices, and drugs that the industry does. But to talk about a waste of time, talking about conflict of interest, it's quite astonishing. I mean, the question is, what are the consequences, the negative consequences of talking about this? I mean, are we actually inhibiting the implementation of scientific discoveries? Are we discouraging collaboration between university researchers and drug companies? Is there any evidence whatsoever that that's happening because some of us are talking about conflict of interest and being concerned about it? I find no evidence whatsoever.
Well, at least at the NIH, that's not true, Dr. Kassir. The big congressional investigations have resulted in problems in interacting with industry and problems going to other academic centers.
Oh, but
in general, I agree with you.
How many people have left the NIH because of conflict of interest? Maybe a handful.
Well, more than that.
Trivial numbers.
NIH. Hang on, let me get one at a time in here. Dr. Stossel, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, well, I think Jerry is right. We should discuss it. It's good to discuss these things. But I think the key word, he used the word chance of loss of objectivity, chance of negative outcomes. Dr. Emanuel Ezekiel mentioned, well, does it hurt patients? I would argue that if we're going to take this seriously, let's get evidence. Now, I think there is evidence that this obsession with conflict of interest has caused a downside. I know of companies that have lost the valuable service of NIH intramural investigators from their advisory boards. That has to hurt product development. Some of the institutions, like my own, Harvard Medical School, has pretty draconian rules that have prevented technology transfer from taking place. I'm working with the Association of University Technology Managers. We're going to try to get the quantitative data to this point. Certainly it exists anecdotally. Now, Jerry, you were in the JAMA where you said that all research support to universities from commercial concerns should go into a pool and be doled out by the academic industry.
No. We never said that. We said that educational funds, not research. We never said anything about that. And that article doesn't talk about research at all.
It does talk about
research. No, it doesn't.
Gentlemen, you'll have to argue this out of court.
and I think also it's legitimized the abuse of leading physicians. The press, I don't blame the press. Most of my families are journalists. I understand it's hard, but they hear authorities saying this is a serious problem. And
well, let me just see if I understand you, Dr. Stossel, correctly. You don't see it as a serious problem, and you don't see how we could see it as a serious problem, where doctors are paid thousands and thousands of dollars by drug companies to promote the drugs of the drug companies.
I think the question is, are physicians inappropriately prescribing drugs or not?
But that's not the question I'm asking. I mean that is another question and a legitimate question. But you ask why the press doesn't, you can't understand the press seeing this. But when we investigate and we find out how drug companies are paying doctors to take them to conferences, to speak to other doctors, to go to lunches, I had someone who runs a very big office tell me that reps come in and sit in the examination room with a doctor. They're not doctors themselves, and the doctors pay $2,500 just to let the reps sit in the room there. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not specifically familiar with
that. There are all kinds of things that are going on.
Wait. Yes. Can I, Ira, can
yes, let,
let's
please.
Let's get a little clear.
Okay.
That is a problem, the sitting in the room, because it violates the patient's confidentiality.
Well, they ask the patient.
But,
they ask the patient, do you mind if the doctor
disrupts? Well, they ask the patient, but they also don't usually say this is a drug rep.
I agree with you.
Wait a second. That's a violation of confidentiality. I think Tom is raising another question, which is, you're concerned about the $2,500 that a doctor is getting to give a talk promoting a drug company's drug. And you say, isn't that a problem? Shouldn't we be concerned about that? And I think what Tom is saying quite appropriately is, let's try to examine and tease out what the harms are. Mm-hmm. So one harm could be patients are getting inappropriate medications that harm the patients. Another, and the evidence on that is, I think, very low. Another harm, which Dr. Kassirer mentions, and I agree with, is it leads to use of certain drugs which could increase costs and expenses by using, say, brand name drugs rather than generics. We have data that that does happen, and that is a problem. So I think it's very important to be careful about mm-hmm. what the exact harms of these.
Well, can I add another harm?
Yeah.
I've heard from doctor's offices cases where a drug rep will, because he wants you to use his drug instead of the competitor's drug, will tell you, and I heard of this one case in specifics, where the drug was supposed to be given five times, let's say, a course of five treatments. And the drug rep said, if you use our drug, you'd only have to give it three times, and you can save money doing that. And the doctor said, but it says on your insert it has to be given five times, not three times. And he said, well, I'll give you any data you want to back up it'd be given three times instead of five times. I'll send you anything you want so you can justify just using the three doses. You find that legitimate? You find that as harmful?
Oh, I mean, obviously it's harmful.
Sure. I mean, there
also, Ira, this is Jerry again. I think also the free sample bit is something that we ought to at least talk about briefly. It sounds really a terrific idea to give free samples to patients, especially indigent patients. And I certainly agree that that's a good thing to do. The problem with the free samples, there are several problems. First of all, a lot of those free samples are used by doctors, by nurses, and by office personnel, and not by the people who really need them. And secondly, the fact is that you give a patient a free sample of all, it always is the most expensive drug because it's the newest one. They don't want you to give the generics. So you give the free samples, the patient runs out of them and then has to pay a lot of money to finish the prescription. And mm-hmm. finally, because you're using the free samples and you're used to using the most expensive drugs, you get used to using the most expensive drugs, and of course that drives up the cost of care. There's some hospitals that have actually given up free samples completely and found that their drug costs have fallen. So it's the free sample stuff sounds terrific, but there are lots of problems with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sandy Freeman's got a pained look on his face here.
It's been for a while.
He's been sitting here squirming, literally.
By the way, just in terms of disclosure, I was a student at Tufts, and Jerry was one of our heroes. I happen to be 61.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. The bad news is I'm 61 now, so I...
Yeah. Well, there's lots of my students who are 61.
That's good.
Okay. So in any event, moving on. The Gestalt of these learned folks who are talking is that they really don't know what life is like on the street. And I'm somewhat mystified by this. I thought that I've lived a virtuous life. It's true I buy sneakers that may support child labor, and I drive a car that may one day inundate Bangladesh. I don't think that they're in touch.
In what way?
First of all, I think the major thing that drives the cost of medicine is that physicians and hospitals profit from the tests that they order. And this is really the huge dilemma. On the one hand, because of it, there's innovation and patients, get thorough and expeditious treatment. On the other hand, for obvious reasons, it's the major conflict of medicine, conflict of interest in medicine. And it's an incredibly difficult thing to sort through. As far as my patients are concerned, they say this is expensive. Let's find the cheapest drug. Mm-hmm. Zocor, Lipitor, it doesn't matter to me. As long as they get to target, that's the key. The blood pressure, as long as you get to target. So you call the druggist and you find out, well, what's the cheapest drug for this person? And as I said before, and the speaker seemed to have glossed over this, The HMO tells you, the HMO makes a contract. They have a drug distribution company, you know, that tells you specifically what antihypertensive, what lipid agent to give to this person. As far as the, it's been said often here that speakers come and they praise a particular drug at a conference, at a dinner. That's not what they do. Mm-hmm. If they did do that, at least in New York City, it would be considered extremely tasteless. And what they do is talk about the pathophysiology of disease. And what usually happens is people talk about interesting cases and, you know, and how to handle them. And there may be some subliminal, you know, influence. I don't know how.
Well, why would a drug company pay a doctor all this money to not mention their product?
You know, they obviously know something I do. I don't fall in love with the concept that everything an industry does necessarily turns into profit. And I'm not in love, you know, particularly with GM and things of that nature, with the concept that they really know what they're doing. I do know from the receiving end that I don't see this as a doctor-pharmacy conspiracy. But might I make a macro statement about conflict of interest that really roils me?
Sure.
And I think, I don't know what Dr. Emanuel can say, because he's in a certain way as a public employee. But look, you have this drug prescription plan. The actuary who lies to Congress about
I mean, the one that was just passed,
right,
everybody
right.
Said Medicare. Right.
The actuary lies to Congress to the tune of a couple of $100 million. Conference committees, reconciliation committees get together. Democrats are not allowed in. Republicans with proxy members of the drug company, you know, help formulate this bill. Meanwhile, you have a quarter to a third of America doesn't have access to antihypertensives, antidiabetic medications, et cetera. And you have hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that are being funneled in such a way as to protect the coffers of the drug companies. And on top of it, the point man in Congress who got all this through quits his job as a congressman and makes millions of dollars a year working for a pharmaceutical company. You know, talk about conflicts of interest. Never mind your $13 billion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about, wait, hang on, let me, I have to take care of some business. We're talking about conflict of interest in medicine this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato with Thomas Stossel, Jerome Kasira, Sanford Friedman, and Ezekiel Emanuel. Who was John jumping in there? I'm sorry. Didn't hear.
Emanuel.
Yes, go ahead, Zeke.
Well, I'll tell you, Ira, you asked an interesting question there about why would the drug companies pay if they weren't promoting their particular drug? And I don't want to defend the drug companies on this at all, but I think one of the motivations that they have, even if the speaker isn't promoting their drug above everything else, if you think a lot of people are being undertreated for illnesses such as high cholesterol, high blood pressure, depression, etc., if you get doctors to treat more to try to recognize those illnesses and treat those patients more frequently, you know, your sales of your drug are probably going to go up, even if you haven't targeted them with your method. Mm-hmm. So that may be one motivation.
Well, that's
isn't tied to a particular thing.
Well, but that is sort of. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, that's just an explanation for why you say, why would they, you know, don't they just promote one drug? Frequently, mm-hmm. they don't. The second thing I would say, in contrast to what you just heard, is that. There are data, and I do agree here with Jerry Kasira, that, you know, when people go to lectures and hear about a particular brand name drug, they try to get it on the formulary of their hospital. They can frequently try to get it on the formulary of their HMO. It's not infrequent that you can call an HMO and get override of their formula so that the patient can get this brand name drug if that's what you want to use. And so that is another reason. Now, typically in those situations, the main harm is not necessarily the fact that, again, the person is not getting the drug that they should, but they're getting one company's drug over another, and the main harm is cost, driving up cost. Now, that cost is a big concern because one of the reasons we have 46 million people uninsured is that the costs of the system are too expensive. But we should distinguish high costs from a patient having a problem, a medical problem, because of inappropriate use. I mean,
by the way, I this is Jerry again. I think that, Zeke, your notion that the pharmaceutical companies are simply helping to educate doctors about treatments that they're not giving is a bit naive because...
No, I didn't say that was the only reason.
Well,
that is a reason.
Let me finish. And the point is that these companies are pushing drugs for conditions that probably should be treated in other ways. They're pushing it for shyness. They're pushing it for attention deficit disorder, for female sexual dysfunction, and whatever. So they're inventing new diseases all the time to promote new drugs.
All right, Jerry, hang on there because we have to take a short break. We'll come back and talk lots more about this and lots of people on the phones, as you can imagine. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about potential conflicts of interest in medicine with my guests, Jerome Kasir, author of the book On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. That's out in 2004. Thomas Stossel, co-director of Hematology Division at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the American Cancer Society professor at Harvard Medical Center. Ezekiel Emanuel, chair of the Department of Clinical Bioethics at NIH. And also with us is Sanford Friedman, a cardiologist at Mount Sinai, an associate clinical professor in medicine and in cardiology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Jerome, you were making a point when I really interrupted, or finishing one?
No, I actually finished the point.
Okay.
I did want to make a comment about this issue of the speakers. The question of, are speakers giving, the speakers who are paid by drug companies, are they actually giving lectures that are in favor of the companies who support them? Well, they certainly are being paid by the companies, and you can be sure that if they don't continue to stay on the company line, they won't be speakers for long. And we learned about that actually on NPR from Snigdha Prakash's report, in which she made the point that when the Merck speakers were beginning to tell their audiences honestly about the risks of Vioxx, some of them were threatened by a Merck vice president. And so that people are listening in on these speakers to make sure that they're saying the right things.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out that the Merck people were listening in on the Pfizer speakers. So uh-huh. Everybody's listening to everybody else and being very careful that they're sticking to the right points for the company.
Sandy Friedman, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Jerry how many of these lectures he's actually been to.
Oh, I've been to many of these lectures, and
what was your experience?
Well, the problem, Sandy, is that I'm not a particular expert in cardiology. So if I go to a cardiology lecture, I can't tell whether the cardiologist is being biased, but I can tell you that I have a friend at Yale who went to an expert cardiologist who went to some cardiology lectures and listened in and came, this is lectures at major medical meetings, and came back astonished at how much bias there was in some of these talks.
Let me go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Chris in Denver. Hi, Chris. Chris, are you there? Chris, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm having trouble with this phone. It's a speakerphone, and I can't get it off. So
it's okay. We hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Anyway, thanks for having me. I love your show. I'm a physician geriatrician in Denver, and I used to have drug reps in the office, and I did it mostly because I could have them feed my staff. But and I'd eat sometimes. So, yeah, I need something for my time. You're listening to your guests talk about HMOs and the bureaucracy in medicine. A doctor can't, you know, do all this stuff for nothing. There does need to be some kind of remuneration for his time. And I think it's just that. I never thought of, gee, this guy gave me some pizza. I'm going to write for Mevacor versus Zocor. That never crossed my mind. I'm a physician. I hold myself to a higher ethical standard, and the patient comes first. And, you know, I think that most doctors operate that way. And there isn't a quid pro quo, if you will, that was mentioned earlier. And
let me get a reaction.
Ethical credit.
Yeah. This is Zeke Emanuel. I think, yes, most of us think that we wouldn't be influenced, and I think that may be part of the problem, is that we're not suspicious enough of ourselves, of our own motives. Certainly when we, as citizens, look at politicians and see them taking checks even for pretty much the same amount of money, $1,000 or $2,000 as physicians get for a lecture, it doesn't surprise us that there's a correspondence. And, of course, politicians are the same as doctors, and they say, well, you can't buy my vote. So I do think we need to be a little more suspicious of our motives. That's not to indict any particular individual. It's to talk about general human tendencies. And the second thing I would say, Ira, is, I mean, it does, you know, one of the things that struck me is when I was a poor house officer, you know, why was I willing to take this pen that was probably cost 49 cents or this meal that, you know, cost a couple or three or five or even $7? It seems to me that this is chicken feed, frankly, and it's not clear to me why the small stuff we just can't get out of the system completely, because it really shouldn't be there and shouldn't be something that doctors take and or offices take. And I think there ought to be, I mean, we can just get rid of that taint, even if it doesn't cause anyone any harm. The taint is something we ought to get rid of.
This is Jerry. Chris makes a very important point. What I think Chris is ignoring is that the drug reps who visit your offices have perfect information about what you prescribe, because the pharmacists are selling that information to the drug reps, and drug reps tell you, in fact, it's already written in books, that they can go into a doctor's office, recommend a certain drug, and the doctor will say, yes, I'd be glad to do it. And then when they don't do it, the drug rep knows it, goes back and says, gee, doctor, you promised to use this particular drug. So the pharmaceutical companies are not about to hire 90,000 people and spend this huge amount of money unless they felt and or have evidence that this stuff works. Of course.
All right, hang, doctor, I want to go to Dr. Stott. Yeah. Doc, I want to go to Dr. Stossel first, then I'm going to take a call and then go to Dr. Friedman. Go ahead.
Yeah, just I want to give Chris a plug here. I think that it is way too much not giving folks the benefit of the doubt. The way the game is played is that people ask a doctor, are you influenced by gifts, by pizzas, by whatever? And the answer depends on the way the question is asked. Of course, they know they say no, but I think they know they're influenced, but they're getting many, many influences. I have family in parts of the country who are getting medical care far removed from academic centers, far from Park Avenue, and they're getting pretty good care because they're getting information from industry. So I just think that this obsession with motivation is a waste of time.
Let me go to the phones. Marcy in Laramie, Wyoming. Hi, Marcy.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I was a drug rep for many, many, many years and worked at several companies and sold probably every product for every disease state. And I just wanted to say that $13 billion is way too much, and they're definitely not getting their money's worth out of that promotion. And one of the main reasons why is most of these reps are promoting drugs like, let's take cholesterol products, for example, where there's 12 or 14 already on the market, and they all do the same thing. And so you've got five or six reps from each company going in to see these doctors on a regular basis to sell one drug that already does the same thing that the other 11 drugs do.
Mm-hmm. So why do they spend? Why are they spending all this money then, Marcy?
Because they have the studies that show it works. You know, the TV ads, the direct-to-consumer advertising is hugely successful.
The Ask Your Doctor ads.
Yeah, they do surveys and they say it works. And then their other thing is share of voice. You know, we need, instead of two quality reps going in and providing good representative services, we want to have eight reps going into the same office to sell this drug where there's already five or six or ten in that class of drugs. So I think it's way too much money, and I think there's way too many drug reps. And I agree with what all of the speakers are getting at. I mean, it's definitely a problem, and you guys have really hit it on the head here. I'm glad to hear some doctors talking about it.
All right. Thanks, Marcy. We're going to have to run. Now, let me go to Sandy Friedman.
Well, yeah, I appreciate what Marcy and Chris had to say. Just one minor correction from what Marcy said. Actually, there are subtle differences amongst these drugs. One of the things I would be afraid of is if I didn't have access to the large panoply of drugs that I have, and my colleagues, I think, would say the same, because maybe they all work this, they're all fine for three quarters of the patients, but for a quarter of the patients, you know, they're not. And
right.
if I had to just do one class of drug, if it was dictated, I think that would be a disservice, mm-hmm. you know, to my patients. You know, I'd like to say what I think, and this is presumptuous, what Chris would like to say, and I'm going to say it, okay, and what maybe my colleagues are thinking. Look, in my practice, it's in New York City, we pay $70,000 for maintenance. Our phone bill is $20,000. Our postage is $20,000. My partner and I each see 25 to 30 patients a day. We start work at 7. We get home at 9:30, 10 o'clock, and we're exhausted. And nobody wants to do this anymore. I mean, the kids are not stupid. They're not lining up to do this. And this represents a major problem in terms of, you know, finding primary cares and doctors and internists, et cetera, for these people. And so in this context, for cognitive services, which is mostly what we do, even though we profit from, you know, our own tests that we order, but most of what we do is cognitive, talking to patients, caring for them, not processing them, you get $30, $60, $90 for a half hour work. Well, you can see the tremendous volume of work. Now, it's true that maybe I would theoretically be even more susceptible to bribery. And it's true what Dr. Emanuel said, that I think all of us in all situations, not just this narrow situation, should constantly self-examine ourselves in terms of, you know, moral issues. But it's also true when someone wants, my time is valuable, not because mm-hmm. I make so much money, but because I have so much to do. And if someone wants 10 minutes of my time, I don't feel the least bit guilt saying, okay, give me a ham sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is Jerry. I fully agree with what Sandy said. The problem is that general internists and primary care doctors are unbelievably inadequately paid. And that's a source of a serious upcoming shortage of primary care doctors. And the problem is the specialists are overpaid. The primary care doctors are underpaid. And that has nothing much to do with conflict of interest. It has to do with what the national need is. The national need, as people get older, is to have more and more doctors who can do primary care. And now we have fewer and fewer of them.
We're talking about medicine and conflict of interest this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So, Sandy, what you're saying is that I'm going to take the money because I'm underpaid, my time is worth something, and if these drug companies think that they can influence me, they're a bunch of suckers.
That's pretty much it. I think that, you know, you'd have to draw the line, but
right.
And I think that the amount of remuneration does matter. I think this is penny ante stuff. Maybe in the aggregate, it's not. I don't mm-hmm. know about national policy.
So
I think you have to look at it in the
for you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, sure.
I agree. We seem to be at least, you know, below probably the $2,000 lecture. It does seem to be penny ante stuff. Why the hell are we doing it? Is the lunch worth it? That's what I can't figure out.
Well, you know, that's a fair amount. You know, we're reduced to an issue of watching patients pay $10 copays, $15 copays. You know, and you look at that and you say, well, I mean, is that really what a professional is worth these days? My staff doesn't take, you know, like in academic medical centers, my staff doesn't take our lunches. My staff takes 20-minute lunches, and so we pay for the lunch for our staff so that we can keep them up and running.
Mm-hmm.
We're right on top of our staff. We have 8 people working, multitasking around the clock. They have computer skills. This is what it takes to process thousands of patients.
Mm-hmm.
And you help them with all sorts of things that are outside the realm of medicine that we don't have to, you know, go into in detail. So when someone comes and says, you know, we're going to buy you a lunch, and I'm spending $40,000 for one person with computer skills to handle referrals and all sorts of other things, you know, to keep my business going, I'm going to say, you know, let them pay the lunch.
You know, Sam, I think what you're saying is very important, because what you're admitting, and I think it's great, is you're in business. Medicine
yes.
is a commercial activity. It's not done by objective robots.
It's a business which is a very bad business model, I might say.
That's,
we do piecework.
But it is a business nevertheless, and we're
yes.
part of the same economic system as the drug
yes.
companies and the device companies and the hospitals, and we should work on making it better, not pointing fingers at prurient mm-hmm. interests about who's...
Well, let me ask one question, Sandy. Do you find that when the doctors come to your office...
Doctors. Drug reps.
The drug reps.
Mm-hmm.
Do they give you useful information? stuff that you don't have time to study on your own? And help you? Do they help your patients with that information?
Really. You see, when they give us lunch, and we actually eat our sandwiches standing, maybe to improve transit time and get on with it. inside joke for doctors. At any event.
You know, elementary, my dear.
Oh, no, boo. At any event, we want to know, so what are the contraindications? What are the adverse reactions? What are the bad things? Are any of these black boxed? Are there anything in the PDR that tells us it's an absolute no-no? So also new drugs come to market. Now, there's a new drug coming out for smoking cessation. Getting someone off of cigarettes, is, as you know, is a tough thing to do. I see that there's an article in the Archives of Internal Medicine. I found it by accident. You know, I have maybe 8 journals. You can't expect a physician to instantly have access to all of this stuff. And here's somebody who came to my office and told me about the pill, which I'm now investigating. So I do think that even though it's in self-interest, there is an aspect of public good.
Mm-hmm. What do you say about that, Jerry?
Well, I say that there are plenty of excellent sources of information about drugs that is not influenced by a drug rep who has a special interest in providing that. There are plenty of excellent sites on the web. There are some computer programs that have drug information in them. There are little handheld things that have information in them. I have a list of such sites which can be useful for doctors. They don't have to rely on drug reps. They can rely on their own sources of information.
You know, we rely on multiple sources of information. Good. Nothing gives me more pleasure. I beg your pardon?
That's the way it ought to be.
Right, exactly. And nothing gives most doctors more pleasure than sitting in an easy chair and reading the New England Journal of Medicine, which Jerry helped make into a terrific document. You know, it's fun to go to surf the internet, but nobody has 4 to 5 hours at the end of the day to do that kind of research.
All right, and that sums up the state of medicine, I think, in this country. And let me thank my guests for joining us today. Sanford Friedman is cardiologist at Mount Sinai Hospital and associate clinical professor in medicine and cardiology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Ezekiel Manuel, chair of the Department of Clinical Bioethics at NIH in Bethesda, Maryland. Thomas Stossel, co-director of the Hematology Division of Brigham and Women's Hospital and the American Cancer Society professor at Harvard Med Center in Boston. And Jerome Kassir, author of On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. He's also a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine and distinguished professor at Tufts in Boston. Thank you all for taking time this holiday weekend for joining us. You know what it's like trying to reach a doctor on a holiday weekend. I thank you all for being with us. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Armania. And Manoli Weatherill in New York. Linda Mack in Washington. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. And we say goodbye today to our intern, Julie Leibach, who produced this hour's program. Her father is a doctor. Her first whole hour in radio. She's been a terrific asset to the program, and we wish her well. Good luck, Julie. Have a great weekend, great, safe, and holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flato. We'll see you next week in New York.